This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with the Pfizer, with the virus. Pfizer and BioNTech, they do expect to deliver more vaccines to the European Union this quarter than currently targeted. We're seeing, you know, some things go on when it comes to different vaccines and getting them rolled out. Denmark becoming the first EU country to drop AstraZeneca's vaccine. So it's kind of a back and forth here.
Yeah, and as far as those numbers, we repeat them each and every day, and they change globally. Cases have surpassed 137 million, deaths exceeding 2.96 million, but vaccines continuing to tick up, more than 814 million shots given worldwide.
You and I each getting one.
I know.
Well, get my second one at the end of the week.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear.
Friday. Hey, let's get our daily check on COVID and the vaccine rollout. Great to have back with us Alyssa Rapp. She's CEO of the healthcare solutions company, Surgical Solutions. She's back with us on the phone from Deerfield, Illinois. Alyssa, nice to have you here with Tim and me again. How are you?
Pleasure to be in touch with you both again, and I too am one shot in, different from the last time we spoke.
It feels different, right? Doesn't it feel different?
Totally.
Well, okay, so tell us what you're hearing, especially with your healthcare workers. I am curious because of the J&J vaccine. Yeah. There's already a fair amount of vaccine hesitancy out there. How does this make that potentially worse?
There's no question it makes it worse. And I agree with Nate Silver of 538 fame, that the statistician, that he's worried that the hesitancy will get more people killed than actually getting the vaccine, because cases out of 7 million is by no means statistically significant, as terrible as it is that anyone had an adverse reaction. But I am concerned, because J&J, the one and done, was such a convenient thing to do and such a good thing to do for many healthcare workers and others alike. And
college
so
students,
concerned.
I know a lot of college kids who that's how
totally.
They got it, yeah.
Well, also for the people who are the elderly who have potentially more depressed immune systems, it was not necessarily as rough or lethal. So it's really unfortunate, obviously. I don't know if I agree with the decision to pull it, nor did Nate Silver. It is what it is. It does increase hesitancy. The only silver lining in spite of that is that there's been such improvement on distribution that I've talked about with you all before, and how challenging it's been. And finally, we're seeing more vaccination appointments at Walgreens and CVS and Sam's Clubs, et cetera, just like we had forecasted that would be a great solve. And so at least there are more places to get vaccines if and when you are ready, more being produced. So even if it's limited now to temporarily exclude J&J, at least there are more places you can get it if you want it.
Is there any silver lining that we can look at, in the sense that this is not just a story about J&J, but it's also a story about Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, given that so many of those shots have been given and there haven't been those reports of those serious adverse reactions?
And Tim, and 95% efficacy once they're administered.
Yeah.
So I'd take it one step further and say these are Cadillacs of vaccines. And if you can get them, you're incredibly fortunate. Go do it. And you know, you're already getting almost 80% immunity with the Pfizer shot after shot one, which is a real big deal. To your point, it feels good to be vaccinated. It feels good to be freer. So I do think that's really, really a positive.
Look, I got to say, I'm just like nodding in agreement here. It was such a relief for me to, you know, it was 10 days ago at this point, to drive out of that CVS parking lot with that Band-Aid on. It felt like a weight had been lifted off.
Yeah.
You know, because we're in this pandemic, and like this is the first step and most important step to get out of it.
Well, and I'm going to add on to that, that this past week or a week ago, we had a little scare at our home and it was a false positive. But nonetheless, we went through the quarantining again and my daughter was sequestered in her bedroom. But I have to say, my husband was fully vaccinated. I had one. She had none. And we're thinking, oh my God, we got this far and we were really stressed out about it and grateful that we ended up all testing negative and everything's fine. But it's a reminder to me, all of a sudden I said in my head, I'm so glad I've got the vaccine. Can't wait to get the second one.
Well, and it's really amazing that, you know, we are very fortunate still to feel this way. Only 22.3% of the country is fully vaccinated and 36.4% are one shot in as of yesterday per the CDC. And so we're still less than 25% of the population, those of us that can jump for joy and feel like we are at least, you know, good to go for this round. So I feel really bullish that everyone who can get it, who's eager to get it, should. And if it's Pfizer, Moderna, it takes two shots versus one for at least a period of time, so be it. Do the two and just keep going.
Alyssa, how's this playing out when it comes to your staff who's on the front lines? Because we have talked to you in the past about vaccine hesitancy among frontline workers, among healthcare workers. But we've also heard about data that show that when more people do get vaccinated within social circles, people start to get on board if they were hesitant in the beginning. How's it playing out for your employees?
We have, as you would imagine, it's an astute question. We have had pockets of perseverance and pockets of hesitancy. So some of the hesitancy has not surprisingly dovetailed with states or geographies that are more hesitant in general because of their political persuasions, and where we've seen there being a lot of administration of the vaccine, like New York City, people are much less hesitant and much higher vaccination rates even within our own firm. I think that what's interesting is that how Corona continues to play out is also really geo-focused. As Fauci said, it might be all along. We've got hospitals in Michigan that are already teeming with COVID patients again, fearing the second variant is here, and there are other places that are like empty with COVID right now, which just isn't happening right now. Empty might be too strong, but very low incidence of COVID patients. So
varied. It's going to be endemic, right? This is part of our world. I mean, I was talking to a bunch of CEOs this morning for a Bloomberg event, and they're like, we need to be ready for the next one because it's coming. Right. I mean, how do you guys see it? What are the conversations, Alyssa, you guys are having around that?
Conversations are get the first round of vaccinations, preferably with the 95% efficacy, because then to tweak around the margins for variants with boosters is much easier than if you're starting from base zero. And if you, and then of course, if you have already gotten vaccinated, even if it is a variant that isn't perfectly protected, maybe it'll be a diminished immune response. So you just have to hope that this first round of vaccinations is laying the foundation, which I actually genuinely believe it is.
Still thinking about J&J here. Even though this happened, you know, they're at this point close to 36 hours ago. Do you think this is the end of the J&J shot? Even if it,
no.
If it, you don't. Okay. So even if it,
I don't, I'm not a J&J, I have no insider information on J&J and I'm not a board member, but they've administered 6.8 million doses and there were six cases and they were all amongst women who experienced these low levels of blood platelets in combination with their vaccination. So do I think there will be necessarily additional screens and flags of when you should not necessarily get the J&J shot? Sure. But it's a blood clot, you know, the cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, CVST, which hopefully they can research further and help screen better for the patients who would be at risk or tweak the vaccine to not cause that response. But again, I do agree with Nate Silver. This is unfortunately statistically insignificant. And, you know, the risk of getting COVID and having a really adverse health reaction is higher than the risk of having an adverse reaction from J&J, let alone anything else. So,
but when I say, I don't mean that it will be permanently pulled or suspended. What I mean is, even if it does get back to the point where the agencies are recommending that it be given in states, is there a chance that that ship sailed when the agencies made this decision to make this recommendation and it ultimately led to people saying, okay, well, no thanks to the J&J. Instead, I'm going to go with the mRNA shots.
It could. It could. And the other reality is we also don't know what else is on the horizon to be for emergency approval. I know AstraZeneca and others that have been produced globally are not popular or used here yet, but there will probably still be additional innovations yet that can continue to protect Americans from COVID-19, this variant or others. So I'm still going to bet on the technology and the innovators. It's just how I'm wired and what I believe in. But I do think that, you know, it's a tough position to be in for J&J. I don't think it'll be the last we see of their vaccine. But even so, whether it is or isn't, fortunately, we have enough of the others being produced and so much more widespread distribution that really, you know, if people want to be getting these vaccines after April 19th, which we obviously hope they do, they should have no challenge doing so. There are some states that have much higher stats than the national averages I've given you, 22% fully vaccinated. Some states, anyone over 16 has been eligible for a long time,
right.
Less populous states. But there are states that are closer to herd immunity than the country as a whole. So let's all get there as quickly as we can.
How important is it all that we all get there quickly globally, Alyssa, in order to really getting ahead of this and beyond it?
I think economically it's absolutely crucial, and I think pragmatically it's also really important. We live in a global marketplace and a global business enterprise, and the phony and false yet real, I guess that's an oxymoron, walls we've put up in this last year and a half in terms of freedom of movement internationally have real consequences. I haven't been able to get my au pair in from France on a very personal note. I have friends who are not being able to see loved ones with ease in Europe. Though we need a solve globally for these vaccination schedules so that we can begin that freedom of movement and goods more easily, absolutely, as soon as possible. It'll be best for the global economy. Otherwise, the people negatively impacted, the countries negatively impacted by this are going to get even more acutely, you know, impacted economically.
Alyssa, we always like to check in with you about the health of the business. Speaking of economics, just give us an update about where you are with Surgical Solutions and also what you're seeing in the healthcare industry right now as it weathers more than a year of the pandemic.
Absolutely. So March 2021 versus March 2020, we were actually, we'll call it and March 2019 even more poignantly, we had seen a nice material jump in terms of same-store growth, meaning elective surgeries were back, things were operating at the levels we would want them to be considered have recovered. Now, again, that's not even, and that's not everywhere, but that is, by and large, it was a very strong March. Things like the major global freeze in Texas, the winter storms, the Arctic events, those that did depress elective surgery volumes in January, there seemed to have been a recovery in March, seemed quote unquote back to normal. But, you know, hospitals are still going to end up likely losing as a whole $53 billion this year. That's 53B in a best case scenario in this country because it's been so expensive to support all of the COVID-19 pandemic related healthcare needs. And so the good news is the CARES Act is helping keep our healthcare system in the black. The better news is that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention and people are truly learning to operate as leanly as they possibly can. But it's going to be, I think, spotty. We'll have strong months like March, like we just did as a company, and I think in healthcare. And then we'll also have probably some dips if and when those variants take a surge and we see that there are places that keep popping up, like I know Michigan is right now, teeming with COVID patients.
Yeah, it's been a long year, long 13 months, as somebody reminded Alyssa. And you have been so kind to always find time for us and just keep us up to date on what you and your team are seeing. So thank you for us. Glad you're still doing okay and your team is doing well as well. Alyssa, thank you. Alyssa Rapp, CEO of the healthcare solutions company, Surgical Solutions, once again joining us from Deerfield, Illinois.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, this week's cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, which will be out on newsstands later this week, as well as online and on the Bloomberg Terminal, is about a 23-year-old programmer, Tim, who is keeping American extremists online.
Yeah, his name is Nick Lim, and he provides tech support to U.S. networks of white nationalists and conspiracy theorists that have been banned by the likes of Amazon. Joining us now is Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, joining us on the Access Line from Brooklyn, and William Turton, cybersecurity reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from New York City. Joel, William, this is just a fascinating story. It's technology. It's about free speech, and it's also about this 23-year-old. Joel, who is Nick Lim?
So
Nick
the
Lim
story actually. Yeah, Turton go with that one. No, Bill, you did a great story. Go ahead and take it away. Who's Nick Lim?
Nick Lim is the CEO and founder of Onmatech, which is a technology startup that's headquartered in Vancouver, Washington. And it provides kind of a specialized set of web services that are key to keeping websites online. Now, you know, the websites that we kind of mentioned here, Nick doesn't actually host them, but he provides an essential service that keeps them online.
So Joel,
I'm
just
significant about that is the context that the world has found itself in since January 6th, right? And what the U.S. Experienced then and the aftermath of it, as a little bit more attention was paid to where internet infrastructure lies. And what we saw afterwards was that, you know, the AWSs of the world did a little bit closer look and basically kicked a lot of people off their products. So where Nick Lim fits into all of this is that he's basically a service provider of last resort. And so, William, just talk us more about like how Nick Lim became that, and why he feels that that's important.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking earlier that it's a story about technology and free speech, but it's also kind of a story about nihilism. Nick is someone who, you know, according to people I spoke to, is technically skilled. He is actually proficient in providing these services, and has been doing it from a very young age, actually, but. You know, to him, I mean, he kind of summed up his ideology to me as, if it's legal in the U.S., I don't care. And, you know, at one point he told me when he offered free services to Andrew Englin, who runs the white nationalist website Daily Stormer, that raised his profile and made him famous. So, you know, Nick would profess to care about free speech and providing a platform to those who have been censored by big tech. Then he would also say, you know, as long as it's legal, I don't care.
Well,
and who are some of his clients?
So, you know, the most important client of his and one that he has actually a very close relationship with is 8kun, which is the home of QAnon. It's where QAnon posted. And, you know, the people who run that website are widely speculated to be Q. And Nick even went to Japan with those people to celebrate the launch of the site. And Nick was integral to bringing the site back because Cloudflare took the site offline after multiple mass shooters had posted their manifestos on, and they needed a replacement for Cloudflare. Enter Nick Lim. He's the one who kind of revives the site and is able to keep it online during, you know, the peak of QAnon and to this day.
So, you know, what's interesting too, William, I mean, there's so many aspects to this story that are fascinating, and you just want to know more about this guy that's behind us, this 23-year-old. But at heart, he's an entrepreneur, right, who just, it sounds like, wanted to start a business. But at the same time, he's allowing these extremists who are getting kicked off, you know, the established programs or platforms to continue to kind of go about their business.
Right. But I think with Nick, that's kind of the whole point. I mean, he
actively seeks out these clients. And, you know, Nick tried to claim to us that he has actually thousands of clients, but in reality, he has a small handful of clients. And they are these kind of fringe right-wing websites.
So, William, you actually went to Washington, Vancouver, Washington, which is just outside my hometown of Portland, Oregon, in the fall, actually, so before all the events of January went down. Talk to us about what it was like to visit him.
So, you know, he actually, you know, he split his time between there and Nevada where he lives, or Arizona, rather, where he lives in his mom's condo. But the VonmaTech headquarters in Vancouver, he rents out to some of his friends from high school. You know, when I walked in, I looked on the table, I saw, you know, McDonald's fries and half-smoked joints everywhere. In the backyard, there's weightlifting equipment, a shed full of servers that are mining cryptocurrencies, and like four bongs. So, you know, they nicknamed the house Amsterdam. But it is also the registered headquarters of this company. And, you know, I was sort of surprised. You know, I wasn't expecting much, but I was still kind of surprised at just the semblance to a college dorm room. And especially because Nick had initially told me that actually, you know, he has offices that sometimes his employees go to. It turns out, not true.
Wasn't it his grandparents' house, though, too?
That's right. According to state records I look at, the house was gifted to him by his grandparents.
What was his upbringing like? Because he sort of has this image of, or portrayed, you've conveyed this image of growing up without money, but he was also posting photos of driving around in exotic luxury cars. There's like a lot of contradictions here.
Yes, completely. You know, Nick in our first interview told me that his kind of early entrepreneurial spirit came out of a necessity to support his family. I tried to talk to his family. I tried to talk to his parents, some of his siblings. None of them got back to me. But, you know, when I found Lynn's old YouTube channel, I found, you know, him driving around in his dad's white Lamborghini. So it wasn't exactly a story of, as he told me, you know, creating these businesses in order to, quote, put food on the table.
So, William, like, let's spin this forward a little bit. You know, there are, you know, free speech rights in this country, and clearly Nick Lim has found a way to bask in them. But what kind of ultimately could, how could this come down on him? Because, I mean, he is walking such a delicate line here, and it just feels like someone is, you know, potentially in a position to you know, elbow him out yet.
Right. I mean, someone could, you know, someone a little bit more adept might come in and offer a similar service. But, you know, something I was actually surprised about, I mean, the people I did speak to said that Lim really did have technical skill and that he was good at doing this. And, you know, I found tweets from him as an early teen talking about his interest in DDoS mitigation, for example. You know, as far as liability, I don't really think Lim has any because he's not doing anything that's patently illegal, right? You know, he's kind of just hosting sites that are themselves stretching the limits of the First Amendment. But, you know, I don't think he's doing anything that would be kind of patently illegal.
I'm just thinking, though, for anybody listening, like, and how you wrap up your story, I mean, it's a business opportunity. When it comes down to it, you know, and he says, what, you know, however you feel about free speech, I mean, this is an avenue where there's demand, ultimately, William.
Absolutely. I mean, this sort of practice is never going to go away. There's always going to be someone that fills that gap. And that's kind of a thing that was interesting to me because we talk a lot about social media censorship and deplatforming, but then you have the question, do you have a right to have a website even? And, you know, the websites being kind of kicked off the internet, it is extremely rare instance compared to your Facebook account getting banned, right? And there's always going to be someone like Nick that can kind of fill that void, I think.
I got to say, I love all the details around his background.
Of course, I'm just going to say, of course he has a crypto mining shed in his backyard. When I saw that detail, I was like, of course he does.
Tim and I went all these different places about kind of like what happens next in his world, William.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess as crypto prices continue to rise, that might be good for him. You know, I'm wondering if he'll leverage his skills into something that's kind of, you know, I don't know, less patently harmful.
Stay tuned is what I'd like to say. William Turton, such good stuff. Cybersecurity reporting, Bloomberg News. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. This story, the cover story of the new issue of Business Week magazine.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic. on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, you are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Goldman equity traders fueling a record quarter amid the Reddit mania. Who said those old guys don't know how to trade? Because they certainly showed up this quarter. JP Morgan Chase, their deal makers, helped usher in the firm's best quarter, but investors still concerned about loan demand. We heard Charlie talk about that. Wells Fargo beating profit estimates, though struggling on expenses, but that turnaround story, investors feeling pretty confident about what Charlie Scharf is doing over there. Wells Fargo, as Charlie mentioned, up more than 5%. Anton Schutz is with us, back with us, President and Chief Investment Officer over at Mendon Capital Advisors, back with us on the phone in Florida. Anton, good to have you here. Got so much to talk to. How are you?
I'm busy.
I know, right? I know. You can. I can only imagine. Well, let's go through the names. Goldman. Investors seem pretty happy. This was all about, it seems like, trading for Goldman this quarter. What stood out for you? What do you think we all need to know as investors for Goldman?
I think what we need to know is the pipeline for the investment banking remains incredibly robust. And it's been really interesting, the controversy that's been caused about SPACs. And, you know, good or bad, these companies have gone public, and they all have a ton of cash, and there's a two-year clock ticking on them to spend that cash. So that means if you're an investment banker, you're coming up for ideas to all those hundreds of SPACs that have gone public. And if you close a deal and you get the advisory fee, you've made a bunch of money. So every one of the investment banks is going to be very busy on the M&A front, just on the SPACs alone, let alone all the rest of the economic activity.
Even if some of the SPACs come undone and they just, I mean, are you so confident, Anton, that they're going to all put that money to work in time?
They're going to try.
Yeah.
They're going to try. And that's the thing, right? I mean, maybe not all of them. I'm not talking about this investment. I'm just saying there's a pool of money out there that really wants to find a home. And that will lead to advisory fees for firms like Goldman. You know, my favorites are some smaller companies like a Cowen or a Jefferies. But, you know, they all helped underwrite these things, and they all have relationships. And they'll be on either side of the transaction, right? It's not just the investment banking fee if you're advising the SPAC. It's the investment banking fee if you're advising the seller. So there's lots of fees to go around. And I think that the tax law changes, assuming there's changes in capital gains taxes, it's going to force companies to go, you know what, maybe I should sell now while the capital gains tax is lower.
Are there homes?
I think that's going to be a driver.
Are there homes for all that money, though?
Well, there's a lot of private companies out there, right? It's not just public companies that these SPACs have to buy. But there will be a feeding frenzy, and you're absolutely right in the skepticism that some of them will not be able to put that money to work, right? Not put it to work in a feasible manner.
Let's talk JP Morgan, down 1.7%, but I just want to pull up the year-to-date. It's up 19% so far this year, even with today's pullback. Some concerns about loan demand. How do you see it for JP Morgan?
Well, you know, you've got a tale of a lot of different business lines here. So let's address the consumer side and the credit card. I mean, you know, we basically had the Fed and the Treasury pump something like 42% of GDP into the economy. You know, consumers have just gotten their $1,600 checks. If they've got a family, they've gotten multipliers of that. And so they've done lots of things, right? They saved it. They've paid off their credit card debt. So particularly on the credit card side, people pay down debt. And, you know, they'll eventually, you know, hopefully come back and spend it for the economy's sake, as well as for the lenders that want to lend them the money. But that's a line of business that there's just so much cash sloshing around that people are actually paying with the cash for now.
So that means so in other words, it didn't generate as much for JP Morgan as it has in the past?
Well, it wouldn't, yeah, right. I mean, because the consumer is flush with cash.
Yeah.
You know, what do you use a credit card when you don't have the cash? And so those credit card outstandings will probably rise as the year goes on, unless there's more goodies for the consumers. They'll eventually start spending their savings, which again, another problem for the big banks, well, all the banks, is the entire system is flush with deposits. So, you know, people are looking at their margins going, oh, my gosh, you know, but what are you going to do with that money, all that money on deposit? What are you putting it into? Bonds? No, you'd rather lend it. That's what banks want to do. So it's a second half of the year story, I think, for the entire industry. As people work down the cash and start to borrow more money, I think earnings estimates are actually too low for the second half of the year for most of the industry.
So given that the quarter was so good, why are investors reacting this way?
Well, you know what? If you look at JP Morgan, it's beaten every quarter for the last three quarters pretty nicely, and it's been down every time.
This was a record first quarter.
Yeah. Oh, it was a record first quarter for, oh, well, yeah, J.P. Morgan, Goldman. I mean, you're going to see that repeated. And, you know, I think it was a little bit of sell the news and a little bit of myopic, oh, my gosh, they may not have loan growth in the second half of the year. I mean, they've told us they're going to buy $7.2 billion worth of their stock this quarter. Okay, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I can't poke holes that quarter. Now, the interesting thing, and I was, you know, talking to a lot of traders today about this, financial traders, and, you know, the banks get punished when they set aside excess reserves. You recall last year us having the same conversation going, oh, my gosh, how terrible things are that they're setting these reserves aside. So how can you punish them for setting them aside and then punish them again for going, oh, my gosh, they're in earnings, so they over-earn because they released the reserves? You know, punish them one way or the other, but not twice.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, what we need to understand, because J.P. Morgan did do a larger than expected reserve release, which added to the quarterly windfall. What do we need to understand about that? You just talked about it a little bit.
Well, I'm not sure anybody wants to try to understand CECL, which was the accounting treaties put in place last year. But it's based upon a lot of assumptions, and Moody's is probably the number one forecaster they use on those assumptions. So if Moody changes its economic model, that has to do with things like unemployment and stimulus and
right.
You know, GDP, right? I mean, if you did this report last March, you know, it was, oh my gosh, right? Set aside a lot of reserves. Same thing in July. Now that report reads very differently. Oh, you got to release those reserves. It's literally straight accounting.
That's a good point. In other words, there's nothing any tricky to it. And we're running out of time, Anton, but we really appreciate it. And we'll get you back real soon, because always appreciate your input. Your fund, by the way, your RMB Mendon Financial Services Fund, it is up almost 32% so far this year, putting it, at least according to Bloomberg data, in the 89th percentile. Anton, thank you so much. Anton Schutz, President and Chief Investment Officer of Mendon Capital Advisors, on the phone from Florida.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, crazy.
Just drive, baby.
Crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
Drive away, take a break. We can reach our destination.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just got about 9 minutes left in the trading day. It is time for the Drive to the Close. And joining us today, once again, Alan Lance, Research Director of LanceGlobal.com, President of Alan B. Lance & Associates. He's on the phone from Toledo, Ohio. Alan, good to have you back with Tim and myself. How are you? And I feel like interesting market environment, you know, now that we start earnings. How are you, or what are you focusing on, I guess I should ask?
Well, I think it's been a situation, Carol, where the rotation has been actually a positive. You know, we've seen a stall in the FANGs, and they've underperformed, and the Intels and the Ciscos of the world have perked up. And, you know, you look at healthcare and tech, has underperformed, and you know, 2021, you're getting, you know, strong as far as momentum from energy, financials, and materials, and they're picking up the slack. And I think that's a big positive. You know, you've got, you know, the hot IPOs of Palantir and Snowflake and Hers Health down 50% from their highs. Even DraftKings is down from 74 to, you know, 59. And I think that's all bringing some rationality in the market. So it's not going to be all just value and cyclicals and at the expense of what used to lead the market, but it's going to be more of a valuation and in-depth analysis, you know, that makes a difference. And that's right in our bailiwick.
Alan, how are you thinking about inflation and potentially hedging for higher taxes, rising interest rates?
Yeah, that's a big thing, Tim, that we wrote about in the last issue of the Lance letter. And I think, you know, we're going to see higher interest rates and then obviously higher taxes and then eventually inflation. I think everybody really has to look at getting some inflation hedges. I would look at real assets. If you look at in the 70s, what happened, and I don't think it's going to be that bad, but once inflation starts rearing its ugly head, it's hard to get rid of it. And I think it's a situation where you want to at least have some of your assets in actual single-family homes and actual natural gas wells. You know, if you can't do that, then, do the next best thing. But, you know, home builders have moved up, so we're not, you know, buying those. They're beyond our discipline buy limits. But actually owning the, you know, physical asset, I think, is going to be important. Another gold has been just discarded here with the crypto craze. I think it's a situation that, you know, buying a Barrett Gold or Newmont, you know, $19-$20 for Barrett or under 60 for Newmont, had a good dividend. And I think that's a nice hedge that's easy for investors to participate in.
See, and I think I'm not sure if I heard you clearly, Alan. Coinbase, was that anywhere in your buying list today?
Well, I think Coinbase is hot, you know, and it's a situation where
it's on,
you know,
sale. It's down 12% from its opening price, so you can actually get a little bit of a bargain right now.
Yeah. No, it's not something we bought. It's something that I was saying that rather than chasing these, you know, the Bitcoin and, you know, 65,000 and Coinbase, you know, that just kept on rising and rising before it finally, you know, came out. We're long-term disciplined investors, and I'd rather take that money and buy some income-producing gold mining, silver mining-type companies that are paying strong dividends and doing well and being ignored. So
you did know I was sarcastic, right?
Yeah,
I hope.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I look, how are you thinking about, I don't want to call it froth, I don't want to use any of these kind of tired terms, but look, we're seeing record after record. We're seeing companies with direct listings with valuations of $100 billion that are tied to cryptocurrency. How are you thinking about the opportunities to put money to work when we are seeing people say that the T word, top?
Yeah, I think you get to look at, you know, the going back to the basics and fundamental analysis and doing it the right way. You know, and it's good that the SPACs have, you know, lost a little bit of their craze and you know, we're seeing as far as the IPOs lessening and that type of thing. We were setting ourselves up for a bubble, really, if this would have continued. So I think the rotational correction we had talked about initially, you know, is very important to the long-term health of the market. But we are definitely setting ourselves up. Even, you know, the tailwinds now that are pushing the market higher, like the stimulus and as far as the still low interest rates, I think, you know, are definitely going to be negatives down the road as interest rates rise and as you know, the stimulus, you get to a point where, you know, you got to do something with the deficits, and nobody's talking about that.
So, hey, listen, we are talking a lot about banks today. What are your thoughts on that? Any opportunities there, any interest, whether it's in the big guys or maybe some of the regional players?
I really like banks. You know, start the year, I think that was one of our favorite sectors when we talked you know, as far as a few months ago. But really, they've moved up, Carol, to a point where, you know, I wouldn't, you know, chase them. One of the only financials that is still within our buying territory, high teens, low 20s, is Rocket Companies. I think they've got a good technological advantage, and you know, can still participate because interest rates aren't going to soar, even though they have edged higher, and that's one of the reasons the stock is still at a bargain. But really, the companies we talked about, you know, 6 months ago, like the Wells Fargo's and the like, you know, have just gone to points where we'd be more likely to take profits in the strength here than buy them and chase them.
How concerned are you about things getting too hot? You talked a little bit about your inflation picks, but I mean, are you concerned that we are going to start seeing real inflation? And we only have about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I think we will see inflation. I mean, we're starting to see it already with, you know, food and I think energy. That's one of the reasons natural gas is one of our big plays, you know, in that energy sector. And I think that it's a situation where you definitely want to position now, because a year from now it's going to be a hot topic, and you don't want to be chasing. You want to be buying selectively and getting your portfolios positioned appropriately now before, you know, prices get out of hand on the inflation hedge front.
All right, we got to run. Hey, Alan, always good to check in with you. Be well. Alan Lance, Director of Research at Lance Global.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie's based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.